Welcome to Trade Off, the podcast about the people, politics, and power inside Europe's trade policy. I'm Tom Moylan. Together, we'll explore the stories of the people who shape and steer trade. We'll get to the bottom of why trade matters, how it works, and why people are passionate about it. These days, I feel like whenever I talk about trade in Brussels, it's just a matter of time before China is brought up. But when we're talking about the EU's trade with China and the complexities of it, it's also about the conditions under which China exports and the amounts they export. And there's a word we're going to use a lot today. That word is overcapacity. So for this episode of Trade Off, I've chosen to bring two people who know loads about China, and we're going to talk about this properly. So to my right, I have Maria Martin-Pratt, Deputy Director General of the European Commission DG Trade. And to my left, I have Agatha Kratz, Director and China Specialist at the Rhodium Group. You two already know each other, right?
How old is your youngest child?
5.
Right.
So we know each other for that much.
Know each other. I remember you when you were pregnant of your youngest child. So 5 years you have.
5 years.
So, before we get started on our conversation today, we have some business to take care of. In every episode of Trade Off, we start off with just that, a trade. So this time, I'll start. I have brought you firecrackers and fireworks, a few little boxes and packets of some rockets and some little explosive balls you can throw on the ground. So what do you think?
Well, I guess we are to assume that these are produced in China. Yes.
Yes.
Probably made in large supplies.
Export 1.3 billion euros per year, I believe. Let me just give you a little demonstration here.
Your children are going to love it.
So maybe Maria, would you like to tell me what you've brought?
Okay, so I am giving you a roughly 950 pages book.
Oh, what? No pressure.
By a fantastic British historian that is called David Aboulafia.
Wonderful.
And the book is called The Boundless Sea, and it's basically the history of humanity, but explained from the point of view of the seas. And why I thought it was relevant is because you see very, very quickly from the beginning how people travel and interacted based on trade.
Wonderful. Thank you so much. Agatha, what have you brought?
I brought you a flask, not a bottle, a flask of cognac.
Oh,
made in France. Cognac is at the center of a trade dispute at the moment, very much so. China launched an anti-dumping investigation into European-made, European-exported cognac, which is, or brandy, actually, that's the actual term. But most of that, 97% of that, is pretty much French cognac. And the importance here, though, and something I find fascinating and quite quirky from the part of China's Ministry of Commerce, is that in an anti-dumping investigation about European-made brandy, they make the case that Europe has overcapacity for cognac, which is a very nice mirror image of the debate that's happening at the moment in Europe, in the US. Also interesting because they're making an argument about overcapacity that really doesn't neatly fit into WTO structures. At the WTO, you can take someone for dumping or you can take someone for subsidization. You can't really take someone at the WTO over capacity, but it shows you how political the term has become, that it's actually made it to the MOFCOM investigation at the moment into brandy.
Now we have completed the trade-off. Do you think that's fair? Do you think that's a reasonable exchange?
Yeah, very satisfied with that exchange.
And it was total free trade.
Exactly. Wonderful. Yes. Free trade. So, Agatha, easy question. In two sentences, please tell me what overcapacity is.
The problem with overcapacity is it doesn't have a legal or even theoretical definition. It depends a little bit on the context and it depends on the industry. More simply put, it's more commonly known as a situation where production capacity is in excess of demand. So think about a factory where, say, 30% of the workers are idle. They're not working at the moment. Or think about a manufacturing plant where two or three of the production lines are just sitting unused. That's overcapacity.
And so why would someone do that?
I mean, if I'm a CEO of a company and I think that the next big thing is going to be Blu-ray discs, I might ramp up production thinking demand's going to be excellent and I might misinterpret market signals. The second possible reason is just that demand comes down because we might be in a recession, and that is also happening. And it's a form of cyclical overcapacity. The other thing that can happen and is going to happen a lot in the years ahead is structural transformation of an economy. Think about a transition to a low-carbon industrial base. And in that context, think about our cars, diesel cars and petrol cars. We're going to probably have too much production capacity for those as we transition to EVs. Most of the time, overcapacity is temporary. It happens a lot. It happens everywhere. It's a normal part of business cycle, but usually it gets solved through the market.
So it sounds like there's two kinds of overcapacity that we're talking about here. One a bit more intentional and the other one a natural consequence of an economy, right?
Exactly, of market forces.
Maria, you're in China often. You're discussing these issues all the time. Do you see huge piles of steel and batteries all over the place? Or is it something a little harder to visualize when we're talking about overcapacity? What does it look like?
I actually think overcapacity looks more clear, not when you are in China necessarily, but when you are in other countries that are receiving those goods. And if you want to get a sense of what's happening, this is not an abstract question. You just need to read the newspapers. You have an article which basically says, look, China this year is expected to export more than 100 million tons of steel. This is more than we had seen being exported since back in 2016. And you don't need to go much further back. I think Tuesday last week, you have, in this case, the concerns expressed not by European, but by South Korean industries, because, and this is a point I think is important to make, this is not a European problem. South Korean exporters are saying, look, products ranging from steel, petrochemicals, textiles, and cosmetics, there is a glut of goods from Chinese rivals. They're also losing market share as regards kimchi, that is so traditional in Korea. Well, you'll be surprised to hear that South Korea imported more kimchi in the first half of 2024 than it exported, mostly all from China, because the Chinese kimchi costs six times less than the Korean equivalent.
Wow, that's crazy.
This is not an abstract issue. Mm-hmm. This is an issue that is being faced by business, as I said, in Europe, in other developed countries, in developing countries, in emerging economies, that see their market share is being affected at home, mm-hmm. in their third markets, and also in China.
Mm-hmm. So what's changed to bring this up onto the agenda these days so much? What's behind it?
I will highlight three. The first one is the scale. This is a different scale and spread of overcapacity than the one we had seen before. We were used to discuss overcapacity clearly as regards steel and aluminium, solar panels. We are also now confronting overcapacity in high-tech sectors, many of which are at the core of the green and the digital transition. And there are wind energy components, BEVs, heat pumps, lithium batteries. legacy chips. I know there's a discussion as to whether there is or not overcapacity, but it's closely examined. So the scale is different. Second, the economic context in which this is happening is very different. The traditional domestic growth engines in China are down, and those were real estate, construction, and you have a very weak household consumption, weak private investment. China has an even greater reliance on manufacturing and exporting. And the third point I will highlight is the geopolitical context. There is no avoidance of the link between overcapacities and excessive dependencies in some sectors. And I think there is a concern, and it's a concern that is in the head of policymakers, that this overcapacity in certain technologies in particular can lead to an increased reliance.
And I see Agatha vigorously nodding over in the corner here.
No. I mean, in this new wave of overcapacity that we're seeing at the moment, we're facing structural overcapacity. Structural because it is linked and it is happening on the back of non-market behavior, subsidies, grants, support, tax cuts that are meant to prop up manufacturers, meant to prop up exports, meant to keep manufacturers and firms alive for many of the same reasons that, you know, we would want to keep firms alive, to keep employment, to keep people in their jobs. But that deployment of non-market behavior, deployment of non-market policies, that is having a huge impact on the rest of the world because it's making overcapacity structural and also because it is having an impact on the ability of Chinese manufacturers to lower price, export in much larger and produce in much larger capacity than they should at this stage. And so the general context here is much more worrying than it was in other overcapacity cycles in the past.
And we're focusing a lot on China here, right? Why is that? Surely they're not the only country doing this.
No, there's a number of ways that this is different. Once again, China's overcapacity at the moment is happening on the back of non-market policies. The problem here is that you've got an intentional policy of increasing manufacturing, increasing production output, increasing exports, right? And so you're intentionally saying, even though domestic demand is weak, which is the case at the moment, but nevertheless, the Chinese government, Chinese policies that are intent on supporting manufacturing and export as a way to make up for a property crisis and for a consumption crisis at the moment in China, right? And so that is creating huge spillovers on the rest of the world. That is the first problem. The second problem is if you're Costa Rica or if you're Slovakia or if you're even Italy for that matter, how much you produce is not going to be enough to displace a whole industry or displace a whole country's firms, right? Whereas in the case of China, if you produce just a bit too much or quite a lot too much, which is the case at the moment, you can actually wipe out entire industries. Let me give you one example, which is passenger vehicle. China is producing 27 million cars, but it is only consuming 13.5, 14 million of those. So that means that you've got more than 10 million cars that need to find an export destination. Now, just to compare that, France produces 1.5 million cars. Brazil produces 1.5 million cars. Spain produces 2.5 million cars. So with that excess capacity, you can literally replace Spain, France, and Brazil in the process, right? So that intentional policy is necessarily a policy that hurts others.
So it's a mixture of intention and size here.
Exactly.
It's what we're talking about.
And non-market behavior.
Okay, and so why do we care about this in Europe?
Why do we care in Europe about China's behavior? Well, because we're buying so much from China and because what we're buying from China can replace some of what we're producing at home, right? And this is why we're so worried about electric vehicles at the moment, because we have the case of solar panel from the past, 2014, 2015. And we know that when China starts overproducing a certain good where we're decently positioned to also be competitive globally, then things can go really wrong. And the solar case is one where China completely wiped out an entire European industry, right? And so we care because, as Maria said, the scale of this overcapacity cycle is even greater than the ones we've seen before. And if that's the case, we're going to need to buckle up and we're going to need to try and understand how we try and protect, how we try and preserve fair competition on our market through WTO rules, of course. But we absolutely need to be thinking about jobs, and we absolutely need to be thinking about companies and industrial clusters in Europe.
Yeah. And it's not only the injury in Europe. It's also the fact that our companies, and many of them are extremely competitive in, say, green technologies such as wind, they are increasingly facing the effects of the non-market policies and practices, the unfair competition in third countries. So companies that were very competitive and very present in third countries, say, for instance, in the Far East, in places like Korea, are now facing a competition that is not always fair competition.
The big titans of trade are slugging it out. The US, the EU, China. What's happening in other countries?
What's happening in other countries is equally concerning. China's trade surplus with the G7 countries grew by a third between 2019 and 2023. It more than tripled with developing economies. They, in my view, suffer like a double hit from the Chinese current overcapacities. China, despite having gone towards high-tech sectors, it has not really let go what you will define as low-tech sectors. Take, for instance, textile. So even if there was a period of time where there looked as if there was going to be a certain localization in developing countries, including of Chinese businesses, that seems to be a trend that is being reversed. And that basically is depriving developing countries of probably the type of sectors in the economy that you normally start to run and to grow.
Since the start of the pandemic, China has increased its trade surplus by the size of the Belgium economy. So just to give you an example, when we speak about trade surplus, it's interesting to look at exports. So obviously, China is exporting a lot more to the world. It's exporting a lot more to emerging economies. Some of that is good because it's a lot of inputs, and countries like Vietnam or countries like Mexico have actually relied on those inputs to re-export to the US or to become their own manufacturing hub. For a lot of those inputs, China is now procuring 50% or more of those emerging markets need, right? Mm-hmm. So it's a huge dependency on China, but it's also very, very hard for those countries to not just be assembling those inputs, but slowly, as they want to develop, to be also producing those inputs. Now, once again, exports is one part of a trade surplus. Imports is the other. And it might be okay for emerging markets to take a whole lot more Chinese exports if they could, in turn, export more to China, right? The problem is that's not happening either, right? And so in that dynamic, it's not just that China exports more, but it's actually that it is importing less rather than more from emerging markets at the moment, which is quite puzzling if China is growing at 5% as it is saying it is.
So obviously we care, and emerging markets and other markets care. But why should China care?
It probably cares, but it does not mean that it is in a position already to do anything meaningful about it. But clearly, China realizes that many countries are not perfectly aware of the fact that non-market overcapacity is a structural problem, and policymakers are becoming increasingly active and trying to find ways to try to mitigate the consequences. The result of this is that you are seeing tariffs, but you're also seeing other barriers being erected. Thailand recently, for instance, decided that it needed to increase VAT on low-value import goods. So they are trying to find the way through tariffs, or whether it is through other types of duties, or by basically restrictions to entry their market. And if you think about it, this is precisely the worst thing that can happen to China. China has grown and has become the power economy that it is today because it has profited from a free, rules-based trade environment. And this is not going to stay as it is. We are actually seeing at the moment, it's almost like a domino effect. You know, the US imposes tariffs, Canada imposes tariffs, we are considering our tariffs. You will have other announcements of other tariffs. China should care. China has been told this very, very clearly. We have, for years, raised with China the need to address the roots of their overcapacity. And we have done so not only in our bilateral contacts, but also in various plurilateral and multilateral fora. A good example of that were the discussions in the Global Forum on Steel Excess Capacity that China left in 2019. So China did not take our concern seriously, was not interested in starting discussions on new disciplines on industrial subsidies. This forced us and others to react via trade defense and via other autonomous tools.
Another reason why China should care, which is that it's, once again, state-led policies to support manufacturing and export are, at this stage, highly inefficient. We're speaking about wasted money at a time where China doesn't have that much to waste and that much spare.
So if China doesn't stop, what can the EU do?
What we are doing at the moment is to use the tools that have proven so far the most effective ones to protect our economy from the effects of overcapacity that is based on unfair practices and that is basically trade defense. We do have at the moment 198 trade defense measures in place, and of those, 88 relate to imports from China, and those are often, not always, but often in sectors with non-overcapacities, and a lot of it is steel. And we are using it very effectively, including to countervail cross-border subsidies, i.e. instances in which you have a situation where China will grant a subsidy to a Chinese company based in another country and then export into the European Union. So we really are trying to stretch and to use to the maximum our tools.
Is there anything more we can do to defend ourselves? Is there any? What else can be done in the meantime?
The best way out of this would be for China to realize something is going wrong at the moment and to fix the problem. Because as we manage and hope to rephrase it in those terms, hopefully there's more traction on the Chinese side. Because at the moment, whether you look in Chinese media or in Chinese public statements, there's a lot of pushback against the very notion of overcapacity. And granted, that I told you from the beginning, this is a very, very complicated word, and it's really not the right one. The right one is excess production on the back of non-market policies that are affecting the rest of the world. Now, best case scenario would be for China to kind of realize the cost it has not just on the rest of the world. It's important for them, but on its own economy. We've got like-minded partners, and we also have other partners that are reacting faster and stronger than we are, which puts us at risk of becoming what I usually call a sponge market. Because if walls are erected around the US and if walls are erected around Canada or other OECD nations that have a huge buying power for Chinese products, and if Europe remains more open in comparison, then a lot of those products are going to find their way into Europe.
Well, just to add, it is nevertheless important to respond in line with WTO rules, which we in Europe do, like we have done, for instance, as regards the battery electric vehicles, where we have duly followed the rules and procedures set by WTO. Others do not always do the same, and this is further undermining rules-based trade and the WTO system.
I want to take this back to citizens, because these trade defense instruments, these measures, all these different measures, they don't come without a cost, right? So how do you explain to the citizen why we need to take these measures?
I think we should not think about citizens simply as consumers. And that's often what people have in mind when they say, well, you're going to deprive consumers from cheaper products. But citizens need work. Citizens do see what happens in certain sectors. But I think the responsibility of politicians is also to be able to articulate and explain what is being done, and to do it in a manner that is the best possible one for the economy and the consumer. And that's the very, very thin and difficult line between protection and protectionism.
At some point, things will stop, and the subsidization of some of those industries will stop. The problem is, if it happens in 1, 2, or 3 years, it might have damaged our industries indefinitely. So that's the first worry. The second worry is that when things stop, there will be very, very intense consolidation in those sectors in China. Fewer players will stay alive. And when the pressure on the market, the pressure on them diminishes, they'll raise prices again. And so in the long run, there will be less competition against Chinese players and firms. And so they will have much more room to raise prices again.
So who are our friends in tackling this issue?
All of those countries that are affected by the overcapacities that we are discussing. But there you need to unpick a little bit because it's clear that the concerns and the economic structures and capability and willingness to act of, say, the G7 or G7 plus countries is not the same when you go beyond those countries. And the relationship is particularly complicated when you are talking about developing countries. But at this moment, rather than being worried about identifying as many friends as we can, I think what we really need to concentrate is on putting in place much needed cooperation and coordination. Because what worries me is that up to now, you have seen a number of measures being taken in different jurisdictions, but no coordination whatsoever. But by reacting to what others do and putting barriers on barriers, we're losing the benefits of cooperation. Now, I'm not naive. This is difficult to start with because not all countries have the same priorities in terms of economic sectors. but already starting to take some steps in terms of, for instance, cooperation on detecting and monitoring non-market oriented measures and trade patterns, and also an exchange of information ex ante on the autonomous measures that are being taken. All that will already be a very positive step. This is the kind of discussion that is happening at the moment in the G7.
And at the end of the day, I would imagine, or in my opinion at least, Beijing doesn't care as much about what Brussels thinks of its trade practices, and especially what the US thinks of its trade practices. It's going to label that as pure protectionism and just a way to contain China and a way to impede China's development and rightful place in the global trading system. Now, if you manage to get certain emerging economies in the mix, then probably Beijing will care much more, because Beijing still has ambition to be or to pose as a leader of the Global South, a leader of Global South issues, especially as regards their relationship with advanced economies. And so I think at that juncture and in that situation, we'll have hopefully more traction in our discussions with Beijing.
Okay. So it's been a pretty heavy conversation so far. Any final thoughts, any last insights? And please, give me a little hope.
The first one is in a very tightly controlled, tightly monitored media and academic environment in China at the moment. We are finally seeing some economists that are highly regarded in China starting to use the word overcapacity again. For a little while, it was a Western term, it was a wrong term, it wasn't happening in China. Second, we're actually seeing policies rather than public statements, but policies that are starting to address some of the symptoms of everything we've described here today, but the non-market practices, the gap between production and consumption in certain sectors. And then the third, China's economy is slowing, China's fiscal space is shrinking. We're in a context where the Chinese economy is not growing at 5%, and where local governments, which for a very, very long time have been the main spenders and the main supporters of local champions, are highly indebted and have not nearly as much money as they used to have to spend on industrial policy. So, as I said earlier, something's going to have to give, and things will get back to normal at some point. The question is how fast does that go? But what we need to hope is that in the meantime, we haven't lost hundreds of companies in the process and millions of jobs, because that's what we're speaking about.
Yeah, exactly. That's the point. The point is, it's not just how fast it can go, is how much damage will happen until something changes. So obviously, look, something needs to give in China, whether we think that is a direction of change that is credible within the space of time that we need to play with. That's a very hard one, a very hard one also for politicians, to be frank. If we're going to be hopeful, I think we do have now a better understanding of the problem. Hopefully, we start to also to determine which are the areas where we need to act to avoid that they become the overcapacity problems of the future. And I do see a degree of willingness to cooperate at international level, which I'm being very optimistic, leads me to believe that we may be able to get to a degree of coordination and cooperation that is much needed.
Before I let you go, I have a last round of quick-fire questions for you. So, What is your must-take item on a business trip?
So headphones, not only for work, mostly to isolate yourself from the noise around you.
A very sharp eyes for all of the cool cars in other countries, because my son is a car, absolute car fan.
In another life, what would you have been?
What I would really like to be is an artist. I'm flexible. I can be a theatre director, or I can be a theatre actress, or I could be maybe a painter.
I think I would have wanted to be a scientist, but a really hardcore scientist doing basic research. And maybe then my grandma would have stopped to say that I'm a doctor that doesn't change the world.
On your first visit to China, what struck you?
My first visit to China was back in 1999. And those were very different days. So what struck me at the time was the energy in the place, the dynamism. Very different.
My first time in China was for a whole year studying Chinese 2006-2007. And what struck me the most is that whenever I would leave the city, Beijing, back in the days, for a week to go travel or visit the country a bit, whenever I came back, probably a third of the shops would have changed on my street, which was completely incredible. I would just come back to a new street every single time. And that is just exactly why I am where I am today, just fascinated with the country and the economy.
Hidden talent.
I can dance a bit of flamenco.
Oh.
I come from the south of Spain.
Wonderful.
But very basic one.
I have a weirdly excellent sense of orientation.
And so on that, I want to thank you both for a really interesting conversation and a really interesting deep dive.
Same here. Thank you so much.
Thanks. It was fun.
Trade-off is brought to you by the European Commission.